Sean Hughes.
Off the radar.
You're welcome, as ever, to Off the Radar with Sean Hughes, my favourite guest, my favourite and my only guest. and watch, I've been learning how to pronounce his name. We only have in Keith Farnan.
Farnan's in the house.
He gets very excited when you mention his name. Keith, thank you so much for coming in. The thing is, I seem to think all podcasts are just three comics talking nonsense. And of course, we're going to do that every so often. But I just occasionally want the one-on-ones and just to chew the fat, really.
What made you, just can I ask you something? What made you come up with the podcast? What was sort of the, I mean, were you sitting down thinking, you know, did you hear a podcast and think, oh, I could do that much better? Or did you just sort of think, oh, I have these things I want to talk about. Let's go.
Well, I think the main thing was, because I've done a lot of broadcasting over the years, and I thought, how can I do broadcasting but not get paid? And the podcast seemed to be the really good way of going about it.
To not make money while you work hard.
But it is that thing of like everyone else, you get your fingers burnt broadcasting.
Yeah.
Where people won't control things. And this just seems like you can just do what you want. And I enjoy it, so it doesn't feel like it's a major task.
I suppose it's true. You have control over it. Like, if you were trying to do this in the BBC or channel, like, people would be trying to tell you who the guest should be, what you should talk about. Here's the thing.
It'd be very regimented.
Yeah.
We're here. Like,
did you feel that you were like you needed some more freedom? Did you feel that you
It's not so much that. Like, it's a lot of the time. Like nobody's batted an eyelid that we've got no clothes on here, and you know that. Just I wouldn't even normally bring it up, but you know that's just fine. We can be relaxed like that. I think there's too many rules with all those people, you know, and you have to jump through so many hoops.
Yeah,
and that's why, because everyone else, like, because I was born before the internet, I'm weird about the internet, and so it's that thing of. Like, but I was told, but no, it's going to be freedom. People will be able to say all those things. And you're kind of going, well, it hasn't really spanned out that way, has it?
Well, I don't know if it's about freedom, but you definitely get, like, I think in America, because I always think America's slightly ahead in terms of, like, if you think stand-up started in America 20 years before the UK, you know, broadcasting's a little bit ahead. Like, if you listen to some of the American podcasts, they seem to, like, NPR, you know, there's a lot of dissemination of information and opinions and views and counter-views, you know, because you've got a very political sort of right-wing, left-wing happening over there, which is interesting. You know, and I think that's I think the UK is just slightly behind in like one of the podcasts I listen to is like the Kermode Mayo podcast because it's just two guys who really love what they're talking about, and you get that, and I love that about it.
But I was just talking about that the other day, where I love that as well. But Mayo doesn't seem to go to any of the films anymore.
That's true.
So it's just Mark that saw that. Did you like that?
I haven't seen it yet. And then he tries to give an opinion about a film he'd seen before.
But the ideal thing is to have two guys who have different opinions about a film. That's interesting.
The Ebert and the Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel. The Siskel Ebert thing in America, because he's always the thumbs up, thumbs down. Yeah. That was quite the attraction for the fight.
But
I know what you mean.
A lot of people don't realise that Irish people... tend to look to America for inspiration more than England.
And money.
No, but you know, because when I was a kid, like, it was all the American comics that I loved. I still to this day do not understand music hall or toilet humour.
No, you're right. I mean, I think there's certain parts of even things like, you know, Alan Partridge, League of not Extraordinary Gentlemen, League of
Gentlemen.
You know,
who were extraordinary.
They were, but I think it didn't have the impact in Ireland that it has, let's say, like the Steve Martins or the Richard Pryors. Mm. You know, I remember growing up and that was the album you had to get. You know, it wasn't any of the English sort of...
Well, I know, it's that weird thing. Like, I find where, and again, I'm putting this on myself, not on the very talented people who do character comedy, but I have to be told when those things are funny.
Yeah.
I don't just go, oh, yeah,
But we don't grow up with it.
I know.
I've always thought that we've grown up with a very, like a friend of mine, and I didn't even realise it myself, he was an American, and he was in Dublin, we were out having a pint, and he said, look around every table, and he was fascinated. At every table in the pub, there was like three or four people around a table, and one person was telling a story, but you could see the other two or three people leaning in, like it was a blood sport, that if this story didn't go well, these three would jump in, and they'd have their own story, and you could see the intensity.
But this is in America?
No, this is in Dublin. This is an American who pointed it out to me, and he said, if you just look around, this is how the Irish tell stories with great intensity and with the pressure of the fact that three other people are willing to just jump in if you get any detail of the story wrong or if you slow down. And I always think that we have that blood sport element of what
we
talk about. You know, that we can keep talking without even taking a breath. So that I'm even doing it now. you know. Whereas I think the English, they have more time. They breathe a little bit more, and they develop these characters and they develop these scenarios that we never got that, I don't think, in Ireland.
It's interesting, but like you just quite literally just moved up to London, but for love.
6 weeks ago.
Yeah. But which is lovely. But it's that thing of
you said such a tone of that's lovely.
That's the point I'm getting to.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like it is lovely, and it should be trumpets and all that. But were you always going to leave Ireland though?
I think that considering how things were in the last few years, it probably would have happened eventually. And to be honest with you, my missus, who's from England, was just happy to leave because she's a film director and a writer, so she can work anywhere. And like her first film and her first book are coming out in the next 2 weeks in England.
Brilliant.
So it just all sort of happened that it worked out this way. But I think just in terms of, I've always gigged in England because I think that every Irish comedian I've ever liked, including yourself, have always gigged. You gig with like Canadians, Australians, Americans, the amount of influences and the fact that, you know, you go on in a club at 9:30, you might have just followed a guy who's headlining the Comedy Store. You better be good.
Yeah.
And it just makes you better. So I think I would have left Ireland anyway eventually, but it makes me sad to have left. I'm sad that I left.
But
you know,
see,
I feel like I left behind a country that's depressed and sad, and I feel like the bastards have won because bankers have run off.
They're missing you, Keith, but not that much.
They're not missing you at all.
They're very depressed.
Oh, dear.
But what I'm trying to get at as well is like, what parts of Irish culture do you not like?
Oh, I mean, it's. I think, you know, but the parts of Irish culture I don't like are probably the parts of people that I don't like. You know, it's never, I don't look at Irish people and think, ooh, I don't like the way that fella's looking at me now. You know, like, people are people. So it's like hypocrisy. I don't care where you're from. I don't like hypocrisy.
But I disagree. I think, like, there's certain traits to Irishness that, and some of them.
Like what?
Well, that thing of it'll happen. You know, the punctuality. That's
a mixture of charm, and we're not really that. Like, people are fairly, like, people have jobs now.
Yeah.
I say that like we just got them 10 years ago, which I think we did with the Frappuccino maker.
But there has been a sea change in that sense, but that's what used to drive me crazy. And the, because I was listening to the Best of the Pogues just the other day, and I love the Pogues, but if you listen to them, every song is about getting drunk.
Yeah.
And you're just going, you know, as someone who doesn't drink anymore, I'm thinking. And even when someone who did drink, I was slightly embarrassed when I was that drunk. Like, I think drinking's great and I'm never going to knock it. But I was embarrassed about how much I was drinking. And I don't like the glorification of drinking.
But you grew up in Dublin, didn't you? You grew up sort of mostly in Dublin. Like, I grew up in Cork and Cove, which was on an island where basically the centre of socialising was either the GAA club or like the Navy had some stuff down on the shore. You know, you had sort of the regattas, the rowing, the GAA or the pub. That's all you had. There was no sense of any other socialising. So I think there's always been that difference between the city and the country in terms of how you grow up with the pub as the centre of your world.
No, that was the same. Like, drinking, like, that's Irish culture is based around drinking. And this is what I'm saying, which I don't think is such a bad thing, but it's, as I say, it's a glorification of drinking. That sometimes I just go, oh, come on, lads, we're better than that.
Yeah, but there's such, I know what you mean. I do. I mean, there's some, you know, it's the stereotype we have to fight against. But at the same time, there's some great stories from when, you know, you remember great stories from when you're drunk and you end up on a train, like, you know, and you end up three counties away at another barn in the middle of the day and you don't know what you're doing there, but there's a fight and somebody's got money and there's some music playing. You know, there's adventures that normally, because we're so inhibited. Christ. I mean, the Irish with the repression, like, that was one thing I hated, was the sort of the repression we grew up with about sexuality and about sort of what the church was telling you and all that.
Yeah.
That was the way things
were.
But
what age are you then?
36.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought you might have just escaped the church and state.
No. Just I grew up very, like, what do you mean? I mean, I grew up in Cove, which is the parish of Cloyne, where Bishop McGee was claiming canon law until 2008. Which is 5 years ago. So he was claiming canon law.
They were a beautiful bunch of words, which made no sense.
Basically,
to me,
he was saying that he wasn't going to give any documents to the police because he said, there was like an abuse commission investigating. He said because the canon law applied to his parish and not law. He was basically, it was like the equivalent of Sharia law. He was saying that canon law is what I'm not going to give you any documents.
Sounds more like Al Pacino and Scarface.
Well, he was one of the last bishops to see the Pope who was killed And he was then moved to Cove. So I'm not going to say anything more because if I'm never seen again, we know where to look.
Well, no, tell us, what is that mystery about the Pope that they think? What do they think happened?
They reckon he was assassinated because he wanted an investigation into the bank. And this is what the Pope is doing now, is taking apart the banking system of the Vatican, which is meant to be one of the most corrupt in the world and has fingers in everywhere's pie. But there was always that sense of superiority, hypocrisy, and you had to live under it. It was like living under a fascist state, living in a church state. And suddenly you get out and you go to America and you meet girls who never grew up under that, and suddenly you're free and you go and they're thinking, and they love you over there and they give you a drink. And I,
so what age were you when you went to America?
I was 19, 20. And
Did you get a green card?
No, I went over just as a student. But I remember it was the America actually weirdly was where I started drinking. I didn't really drink in Cove. You know, I played a lot of sports. And I didn't really drink when I went to college because I was living at home still. And then I went to America and I started drinking there.
And I take it you were an altar boy and all that nonsense.
Altar boy, minister of the word, minister of the Eucharist. I mean, if I'd become a priest, that would have been the bingo hall of the family.
It's not too late.
I think I'd make a good priest. It would be an alternative version.
Well, weirdly, like, I think, let's see if you're the same. If I wasn't a comic, when I was a kid, there was a possibility I would have been a priest.
Yeah.
Preacher. And I think, and the other thing, lay job for me would have been to be a psychiatrist. And I think those three jobs are very similar to comedy.
Yeah, I think, I'd throw in lawyer as well, right? I'd throw in lawyer because that's what I did as well, because I think lawyers analyse, they take it apart and they put it together in a very different way, which is, I think, what comedians do as well. Because people are always saying, ooh, you did law and now you're in comedy, how different is that? It's not. It's not at all. It's the analysis and the presentation. Presentation is just a little bit different. Lawyer does it in court. A comedian does it in a pub to five people.
And sometimes in court.
And sometimes in court. When he's crossed the wrong promoter. So the psychiatry is really interesting, and the priest, like, have you ever been to the Baptist churches in America?
I'm very aware of it, but I haven't actually stepped in.
They're stunning. They're shows. They are showmen. They are extraordinary. They put anyone to shame.
Did you ever see Sam Kinison?
Sam Kinison.
Seriously, you've not heard of Sam Kinison?
No.
Well, you're just in for your biggest treat. And like, this is for people listening at home. Sam Kinison is the reason Bill Hicks exists. Sam Kinison was one of the finest comics ever, but he was a preacher and he became a comic and he lived a very full life, is the only way of putting that. And he died quite young in a car crash. You're in for the biggest treat.
Was he based in the South in America or was he? And he just never.
Well,
that's funny. How
it's amazing when you look at him, because I love it, the fact that people talk about sometimes that Dennis Leary kind of stole from Bill Hicks, and he didn't. They were just very similar.
Mm.
And when you look at Kinison, Hicks takes some movements, actual bodily movements, because Hicks loved Kinison with all his heart.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring, because I think Hicks was very much the preacher boy as well, and there's that sudden thing. And I think Irish people do it in a kind of guilt-laden way, the way that
they're almost apologetic for the way they are standing before you now and doing what they have to do, and they undercut it at the end. Whereas the Americans are very good at the present, you know, the as you say, the preaching, the presentation.
But bottom line, I think a good priest is not a better virtuous man in the world. It's just that they get such bad press.
Mm.
You know,
absolutely. I mean, the good priests that are out there, you think. I mean, I remember, and the things you get taught as well are very simple, and the messages are honed in terms of. I remember somebody asking me, you know, I said, you know, I'm not, I'd be an atheist, I wouldn't be a practicing Catholic, I'm lapsed. I believe in something. I believe God is the inspiration in your head when you take A and B and you make C. I think that moment that's your God. That's your thing there. And they were like, well, what would you teach your kids? And I was like, well, you know, just be treat others the way you treat yourself. And I was like, ooh, that's basically the Christian sort of.
Well, yeah,
kind of like, be nice. Don't be a dick to everyone.
And, well, like, this is not something I thought about before, but I guess the Bible is just a very bland kind of guidebook to life, you know, in the same sense of, you know, the real bland, you know, when you go to away and you get the bland book and go, well, you should do these, and you go, well, they're pointers to tell you where you should.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Bible's kind of something you put in a tea towel and you put in the kitchen, kind of like, you know, that's where it's ended up half the time. You see all these little proverbs and things, they end up in a little frame in the kitchen somewhere. It's very much that homey sort of deliverance of a message. which gets drowned out a lot in various sort of ways. And it's hard to talk about this stuff, you know, because you talk about spirituality or Christianity or morality or whatever, and people start getting freaky. They start going, they don't hear what you're saying. They hear what they want to hear, you know.
Yeah.
So you start talking about a good priest, they don't hear that. They hear that you want to forgive all the bad priests.
I know.
Like, no, that's not the way it is. There's guys out there who genuinely believe they are serving a better good and they're bringing people together, and that's not a bad thing, but then that's being corrupted because everyone's corrupted.
But I find when I tour, and like I don't believe in any hereafter, I don't believe in any of that. I could say nonsense, but that's in my kind of view, and I respect people, you know, who believe that. But I still, when I go on tour, I'll always go to the, weirdly, because this is the thing, I was in Hereford the other day and they've got this amazing cathedral.
Oh,
and yeah. Around the corner they've got this horrible little Catholic church, and I really felt sorry for the Catholics all of a sudden, how Church of England got these amazing monuments to Christ, and like, you know, the poor old Catholic got these tiny little prefabs around the corner.
But it's always the markers for the Irish. As soon as you go anywhere in the world, as soon as you're on tour, you could be over in Eastern Europe or America, wherever, you find the church and the graveyard. They're like the two things you go to see, because they're the oldest buildings usually. There might be a castle, but it's castle, church and graveyard. That's what you go to see, how they treated their dead, where they buried these mausoleums. The cathedrals always have the architecture, the beautiful, you know, you go to Barcelona, you see the, is it Gaudi's cathedral that's not
but
finished?
You might be the kind of person who, like, cause this troubles me a bit. When we run out of space, where are they going to put all the dead people?
Oh, wasn't it? Attenborough was talking about, this is the reason there's going to be an epidemic, because, you know,
the
world, yeah, the world cleanses itself every now and again. Like, you had the plague in 1912 when overpopulation was happening and expansion. And, you know, you see plagues across the world. And I don't know. I mean, the problem is right now, is that you have such a thing as the third world, and we all live in the first world with our ideas of, like, I had a moment this year when I was thinking, you know, I've always, you know, supported Amnesty. I've always been very idealistic about what law can do and people can do. And then I went to Bahrain to do a gig, and there was democratic protests, and I didn't leave the hotel because there was like the threat of violence outside. They said, listen, you could leave and join if you wanted, you know, but there's all sorts of, the army's 500 yards that way and the protesters will be maybe 500 yards that way. And instead of going out and joining or doing anything, I stayed in the hotel. And it sort of made me reflect on the fact that, you know, when do we put our money where our mouth is? How much do we really care?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we all, you know, most people these days who are doing okay, they'll give some money to charities. You've probably done a lot of gigs for charities you care about, and some maybe who just ask you to do it. I mean, how much do you really care? What would you really give to help someone in another country who really needs it right now? What would you give? Like, not just a fiver, a month or a tenner. Would you get on a plane if they needed you and go over and help dig a ditch that'll divert a river?
And what conclusion did you come to?
I'm still on the way. This is what I like about stand-up, though, is that we can, like, the more experience you get with it is that you can stand on stage and talk about these things, and if you can find the way to make them funny, if you find the twist in it that makes it funny, you bring people with you.
So are you looking at a new show with maybe that kind of...
No, not at all. I don't know. Maybe. Who knows? I've no idea. These are just things that occur to me as I go along, and maybe later on they get put together in a big coagulated
mess.
But
this is what I mean. I think a lot of people would feel this in the arts when you talk about, oh, I'd love to do some volunteer work, yada, yada, yada. But if I go up to Uganda, what use am I going to be to people?
Oh, you can probably be more useful than you think. You know what I mean? You probably have more skills that you know about, more ideas, more thinking, more whatever. You don't know. These people are too tired and too hungry and too scared to think. Whereas you go over with a clear head and a full belly and you kind of go, oh, look, you've got a well over here, you've got a thing over here, but you've got a slight hill. Let's put, you know, let's do what the Romans did and put an... I don't know. I'm just saying.
Well, you can get them all around and go, look, you've got no water in the well, but Englishman, Irishman, Scotsman.
Yeah, laughter is not the food they want.
Because what I tend to do is, like, I've been to Africa to trek mountain gorillas and stuff, and like, you pay a fortune for that. And I actually still don't really agree with charity. Like, I want equality and stuff, but my way of doing that is, like, to give money to their economy for real, rather than just going, here's a handout.
Yeah, the problem with that argument is that that's how some people who go over to the Philippines and Thailand for sort of, you know, sex holidays, that's how they justify themselves. They say, oh, I'm helping out the families by giving these women $100 a night to sleep with them, even though they're only 16, 15, 14. You know what I mean? I know exactly the argument you're saying. Unfortunately, the argument gets corrupted. I mean, nobody has the answer. This is the problem. I hate the people who pretend they have the answer and they're just so blatantly wrong. And you're just like, what are you doing in charge of the UN?
So tell me when. So you were studying to be a lawyer.
Studied and qualified and practiced.
Well,
yeah.
excuse me.
I really did that. I really came in hardcore on that. I used to almost deny that I was a lawyer when I started being a comedian because I was like, I didn't want people
to
know.
So how many years of study was that then?
That was 3, 4, 5.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what was the plan then? So tell it, you got your colours, is it?
Well, I got my... I sort of did it because I was into history and English, and then I ended up working as a law student. I think I much more enjoyed being a law student than I did being a lawyer. I think being a student was amazing. You got to work as an intern. Like, I worked for Barry Sheck, who ran the Innocence Project in New York, and I worked for a defence lawyer who worked against the death penalty in Atlanta, and I was very idealistic.
Sure.
I loved the big fight. It's that Irish thing. I loved being the underdog going in, and you'd work 18-hour days in these cases. You didn't have a chance.
And then you come over and start work over here, and it's going, now, did you definitely slip at work?
But that's it. But that's exactly what happened, because I came back and I didn't want to do criminal, and suddenly I'm doing civil litigation. And I was like, I can't do this for 40 years. I can't. And a friend of mine got a... I used to talk about this. He got a promotion and got a car park space. And I suddenly, my brain frazzled. And I thought, that cannot be what I'm here to work for. And worked towards. And I'd been doing little bits and pieces of improv, and I did theatre when I was college, and stand-up sort of grew organically out of it. But I loved being a law student, and I still love that part of comedy where you can talk about things and you can question things. And I have this awful habit in arguments of coming up with 20 different arguments until I get to what I really believe.
No, which is great, but your parents must hate you.
Well, no. After I'd trained in... After I'd worked in New York and Atlanta, I had a lot of experience in forensics, and I was offered a job in a criminal law firm. And in criminal defence, it's basically bartering your knowledge versus reducing the sentence.
Can we go back a little bit? You were an expert in forensics.
Well, not an expert, not at all, no. But I had a lot of... Like, the guy I worked for, Barry Sheck, was like O.J. Simpson's forensics lawyer. But he set up a thing called the Innocence Project, where they basically were freeing people who'd been in prison for 15 years using new DNA technology and techniques. Because in the 80s in America, all you needed was a scientist saying, this is A-plus blood at the scene, and there's A-plus blood in my client, or your client, the defendant. He's guilty. Juries just went, he is guilty. He's got A-plus blood. There's no other blood like that. That sounds like... And people were sold on really cheap science in the 80s. So this... project, the Innocence Project, is working to reverse all of those cases, and there's thousands of them a week coming through the Innocence Project.
But that sounds like, you know, and like, you're a great comic and stuff, but like, do you not think you'd be making the world a better place if you were helping out do that
every day? I mean, every like, but I also knew. Well, the first thing was, it was in the States, and I didn't have a green card, and I didn't have a way to, you know, and I'd have to sit down and study the New York bar, and that all sort of occurred to me. And I was still sort of dealing with that when I had to finish qualifying anyway. So I finished qualifying in Ireland, and then I thought maybe I'll do criminal defence in Ireland. And I made a choice, because basically a friend of mine explained it to me like this, and she worked in criminal defence, and she said, look, you've got some knowledge of forensics. They'll probably put you in aggravated rape cases, things like that. And you'll work on cases maybe where, you know, your client has been accused of aggravated rape and they'll want 5 to 7 years for him. And you'll come in and you'll spot a few flaws. Maybe you'll debate it down, maybe looking for 3 to 5 years. He gets 2.5, 3 years with good behavior. And you're bartering time off of people you are pretty sure, if you were to honestly sit yourself down and look yourself in the mirror, you'd say, this guy did it. And that's what you... And I walked away from that. And when you explain that, because everyone says, oh, your parents must hate you. You know, you left law for comedy. When you explain it like that, that was my impression of you there. And every other interview has ever asked me that in my life. But it's a simple question. Of course, you left like law and money and security and being able to afford a sandwich to do this thing that we do, which is mental. And everyone wonders why. But when I explain it like that, it's a very simple... I made a decision. That's not the guy I wanted to be in 20, 30
years.
Oh,
no, that's great, yeah.
It's not great. I don't mean it to be sounding great, but I couldn't do it. I believe in the system. I believe there should be that guy there. I couldn't be him. And weirdly, I had worked really hard as a student to become that guy without knowing it.
But explain to me why, in England in particular, when they go to court and the guy will say, and I give you 7 years, and he might as well be going, that's 3.5. Why don't they just go... And I'm giving you 3.5 years.
I think it has something to do with mandatory sentencing being unconstitutional. The fact that, I to be honest with you, I'd be hard pressed to to come up with the reason. But
5 years of study, and that's the best you can give me.
That's why I'm a comedian now.
Like, I just find it always so funny when I just go, and I sentence you to 10 years. And he might,
but this is why John Grisham became such a multi-millionaire, because people are fascinated. Like, the law tries to inflict a black and white answer on the grey of life, and it really we every situation right now. We're in a building. It probably requires insurance. If something happened, we could sue them. If they didn't have the proper insurance, somebody would go to jail for negligence. Every moment of your day, there's some law affecting it somewhere. And people are fascinated by the interaction with how you decide a fight. The right, and like, I was totally naive. I thought, ooh, I'll study law. I'll know some of the answers about what's right and what's wrong, and what's, you know, what's justice and what's not. And you learn about law that it's nothing to do with any of those things. A lot of it is personality, presentation, evidence, rule of law, and being quicker than the other guy on your feet. That's what it was.
Because when you do your, like, it's weird, like, because you do a club set which is just happy-go-lucky, but then all your shows are about quite serious issues.
But no, this is the thing. This is what I've been doing, is that in the last few years, I've been slowly finding the I suppose, just been able to find the way to bring my shows into the clubs. And I'll hit him in the first few minutes with my things, you know, I'll warm him up, and then I'll drop into stuff from my shows.
But not in the Comedy Store and the like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I think, like, you know, a lot of the, there's always this debate about theatre versus club, and I think it's, you know, and I understand the debate. I mean, you grow more, they say, in the theatre, you have to cater more to the crowd in the club. And I think being a good club comedian makes you a better theatre comedian, being a good theatre comedian makes you a better club comedian. And what I've been trying to do is not preach to the converted. I do a theatre show, it's about women's rights. You know, people who come are probably going to agree with me. I do a show about immigration, I do a show, they're going to agree with me. Mm-hmm. I do it in a club. You know what? There's a lot of anger out there. There's a lot of people who don't really agree with me, but they'll engage with it. And that's it. I'm off to the races. And I'm happy. And you know yourself, you just get the skills from put downs in clubs that you can take the energy of the anger and you can use it. And
yeah, I think you can, but I don't think, because I've just done theatre for such a long time, I haven't got the rhythms of the club, so I'm just too elongated for clubs. It takes me like 5 minutes to get warmed up.
Yeah.
You don't get that opportunity in it. I don't.
No, but you get, like you said, like, you just, I'm getting better at finding the bits from my shows that I can just drop into, and away I go. But, and I feel, I think it's working. I hope it's working.
What do you make of the whole, because like, there was that spat at the end of the year with particularly Russell Brand. Like, he's just saying getting involved in politics, but he didn't actually have anything to say at all. But what do you make of that whole thing of, I'm not like wanting you to diss Russell, but I'm just saying.
No, you're talking about when he was talking about the fact that you shouldn't vote. Apathy is this what you're talking about?
Well, no, but it was like, it kind of, again, like the weird thing is, I don't blame him.
This is the Paxman interview you want to talk
about.
Yeah,
but it's not even the Paxman interview. It's more like the Guardian, like every time Russell wants to write a letter, the Guardian go, well, that can be our leader comment if you want. And I just go, like, the thing is, like, he's not a stupid man, Russell. Like, he's very verbose, which people assume is intellect, which I don't actually necessarily think it is. And when it boils down to it, he was like a kind of 12-year-old saying, let's have a revolution, and going, and when he says, well, how are we going to do that? He go, don't ask me, I'm a comic. And I think it belittles comics who actually try to do these things properly.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because he's got a form, he's got a placement, he's a placement product now, where they, like you said, the Guardian will give him access to people.
And shame on them.
And, well, I mean, I don't, look, I mean, everyone's benefiting there. I mean, it's a business. This is a business, yeah, at the end of the day, and Russell's getting exposure, and the Guardian's getting kudos for having this comedian talk about things. And I know what you're saying. I know that, oh God, it sounds like a 12-year-old saying, let's have a revolution. But at the same time, he gets to a point. He gets you to a point where he says he doesn't have the answers, but he's raised the issue, and he's a comedian. And he's a comedian that a lot of young people who wouldn't necessarily tune into Radio 4 or whatever would go, oh, Russell Brand's on the thing. And they'd look him up and they'd YouTube him. And and that's probably the first time they even know who Jeremy Paxman is. So in a way, he's opened a little door there to a demographic who wouldn't normally think about these things. And he gets to a point where he says, I don't know the answer. There should be a revolution. I don't know how you get it. And I've always thought that there's probably 11 or 12 people in the world, and if you got them in the right room, in the right place, you ask them the right question, they would have the answer to everything. It's this sort of, you know, and I don't mean like it would be artists, politicians, scientists, and they just have a view.
Well, Bono would definitely be in there.
Oh, Bono would be in a grave. And you get to, so he gets you to the point where he says, I don't know how to get to it. But maybe he inspires someone else
who thinks,
oh, you know what? Maybe I can come up with the next bit and somebody else comes up with the next bit. I don't think he has any of the answers. I know what you mean. It sounded a bit...
Keith, but if he actually said, I don't have any answers, but he's kind of given the impression that he does.
Of course he does. He needs that. He's got the insecurity inside him. He needs to show. But I actually think in the interview, if you listen to it towards the end, he says, I don't have the answers, because Paxman tries to nail him and says, well, what's the answer? And he's like, well, I don't know. And then you find out later Paxman hasn't voted himself in the past 4 or 5 elections, and Paxman was giving him all this grief about not voting.
Yeah, but
you're suddenly looking at two, you know, but Paxman is regarded as the senior figure in that exchange with more pathos. And yet you wonder if Brand has actually voted more times than Paxman in his life.
But as a child, did you, I didn't like, let's not even go into Irish politics, but it's such partisan, but it is over here as well with Labour and Conservative. And it's just a real shame. Like, as an outsider, I think we can see it better than
I'll tell you something about, we weren't a political family in any way. In a time where in Cork, you were either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael or hardcore. And I grew up in Cove, which was a Labour town. And I watched Cove fall apart because the unions were so hardcore in the dockyard and the steel mill, that the dockyard, which was run by a Dutch company, said, if you don't stop this, you know, because they were taking the mick, and even the dockers would tell you, you know, we were getting double shifts for only doing half the time. And the Dutch company said, we're leaving if you don't stop this. And the union said, that's ridiculous. And they left. And then the Indian company who owned the steel mill said, well, if you don't stop this behavior, we're leaving. And they said, well, we're the union, we're not going to change for our, and they left. And it devastated the town.
Sure.
So this whole socialist theory about how Labour is good for working class places, it doesn't play out all the time, you know. And the unions, I don't know, I mean, because we're getting to a point, I think, where we've exhausted a lot of political thinking, and now we do need something new, but nobody knows what it is.
Well, yeah, but like, everyone knows the political system doesn't work, but no political system does work, and that's a given. But what I think is quite shameful in this country is Labour's move to the right, which just gives no option whatsoever. It's just two right-wing parties now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose everyone thought eventually, or initially, there was the hope with the Lib Dems. I mean, you kind of, you want to look at the, like, I've spent a lot of time in Scandinavia doing shows over there in Norway and Sweden. You kind of looked at them and you think, wow, there's a real socialist conscience along with a lot of money. I mean, Norway have enough money, they could just build a giant robot and just tick everyone else off, but they don't. They really sit down and they look responsibly at what they think they can do for their people and anyone who comes into the country. And I think if you have a combination of sort of strong leadership, which is a little bit, it's practically socialist without being demagogues, and they kind of, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't know where we're going, because Liberal Democrat, everyone thought, ooh, that's a great name for a party. That's a great thought. That's a great idea. But it's like the Green Party in Ireland. As soon as they got into power with the big boys, they had to cave on everything.
I must say as well, for anyone who is bored with politics, you do have to just Google Green Party Ireland for the most amazing speech you'll ever see in Parliament. You've seen that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just...
yeah, I know, it's funny. We started the show by talking about stereotypes in Ireland, and now we're saying to go watch the Green Party in Ireland for the most ridiculous speech in the world.
That was an amazing moment of parliamentary history. But he just swears a bit. But he does it in such a beautiful way.
Yeah.
See, I love that. That's what I love about Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, that capability of that kind of...
But this
nonsense.
Is why we're kind of loved around the world. We are loved everywhere. Have you never gigged anywhere and you've walked on stage and they've gone, you're Irish, and they don't even care who you are. You're just Irish. They love that.
Yeah, parts of Belfast.
Yeah. King's Hall. Right next to the King's Hall.
So what's next for you then? Because, like, see, the thing I love about comics is I've never come across a stupid comedian.
No, you're right. You're right. You haven't. I mean, you might come across sort of maybe slightly lazier comedians who decide that they've got the one thing that's going to work for them for a few years. I've never met anyone. I mean, it's like you said, it's the psychiatry, the preacher, the comedy and the law all wrapped into one, which is a hell of a ball.
But the big question I want to ask you then is, when you're on a tube, do you want, when they do the announcements, do you want them to call you a customer or a passenger?
I think a passenger.
Yeah, you know what they call you?
One.
Customer.
Yeah.
Well, if that's not going to change, nothing's really going to happen.
Viva la revolution.
I think so. Me, you and Russell. Keith, what are you doing for the new year in general?
Trying to get a play off the ground. I got commissioned, so hopefully get that over here, which is about the closing down of docks and property.
What did you do? I didn't know about that. That seemed So who's commissioned that then?
It was Fish Amble in Ireland, along with Universal. Had a bit of money in there, so I've just been running that. Hopefully get that off. Going to try and tour the show Fear Itself, which is the one-man show around the UK. And got a film we're trying to get off the ground.
So, well, at least pronounce your name properly so people know what to look up.
I get it wrong now. Can I do the Irish version, which is Kinnoth the Fallen On?
What?
Yeah, there you go. Say that again.
Kinnoth the Fallen On. Well, listen, thanks for listening to Off the Radar. I'm Sean Hughes. Thank you so much, Keith, for coming in. And
thanks for having me.
Have a lovely year.
Yeah, you too.
Cheers.
Sean Hughes.
Off the Radar.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!